Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. You know, I love talking to authors because they have the courage to take their thoughts, put it down on a piece of paper, and share it with the many, ultimately leading to a new legacy, potentially changing their destiny and impacting the world. And so if you're out there looking to write a book, check out dreamstarterspublishing.com. We can help you out with wherever you're at in the process. And if you already have a book and you want to generate leads with it, check out bookmarketingcrm.com. The author that we're speaking to today is, he's across the seas and he's in some circles that I am not, but he does know some things that I'm very curious about. So the book that we are talking about more so than anything else today is The Sustainable State, The Future of Government, Economy, and Society. And it's an honor to have you, Chandran Nair, with us today. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike, and great to connect with your audience.
Yeah, you're very proactive and great at communication, so I commend you for that. But let's start off with the genesis of this book. Maybe if you can give us a quick little rundown on your pathway of maybe creating the book, or maybe why you actually penned this this book in the first place.
No, that's a good place to start. So, you know, I've worked all around the world. And for about 15 years, I was the chairman of the region's largest environmental consultancy and sustainability firm with 22 offices, et cetera. And I've done a lot of consulting work in this area, you know, way before climate change and net zero were things that people spoke about without understanding the true causes and effects. Then I quit. I sold my stock. I started a think tank, mainly because I started to understand that the drivers of change were much more profound. And to speak about it, I needed to leave the confines of consulting. So I'll get to your point. I wrote a book about 12 years ago called Consumptionomics. And essentially it was the first book that looked at the economics of consumption and described the dilemma we're in, that the economic model that we all depend on and thrive on at the same time is wholly dependent on driving over consumption. I call it, you know, buy things you don't need with money you don't have to impress people you don't like.
If you're middle class,
right? And therein lies the dilemma. And I wrote that, and I said that in the developing part of the world, where you know the global majority live, 80%, et cetera, and with the population peaking and with the existential threats, we're going to have to understand the way we price consumption has to be such that it reduces what the cost of consumption is in terms of the externalities. So carbon dioxide is just one, the tip of the iceberg. And to do that, we need to price consumption. So to get to the second book, many people said to me then, well, how are you going to do it? Because you can't stop people from consuming. But I said, well, if we are serious about climate change and we want innovation, technology, social progress, et cetera, to kick in, to define that future, then we're going to need to understand a different way of thinking about consumption. And in that, I said that in this part of the world, at least, and it might not apply to the developed world, but I see it coming in the United States and North, in Europe, et cetera, you're going to have very clear rules made by the state. And there has been an unfortunate, in my view, a narrative that undermines the state, particularly in liberal democracies, that say the state, that suggests that the state doesn't matter. And that us in business, and I come from a business background, that us entrepreneurs will somehow find a way. So I argue that in this part of the world, and to an extent to most parts of the world, you'll need to have tough rules that then spur innovation. So that was the genesis of the book, and the book argues how this all sort of lays out in terms of the future of governance, society, and the economy.
Well, I'm reading through your background here. It sounds like you speak all over, including some big, big names like the World Economic Forum. Have you been to Davos? Are you a part of that group in any aspect?
Yes, I've been to Davos many times. And I know being associated with World Economic Forum can get you a bad rap, but I want to just make sure. And I think it was the podcast, popular podcast host in the U.S., Ben Shapiro. I think he called me out at 2 months ago as being a Davos acolyte or something like that. And I belong to something called the experts group, and I'm actually an outlier in that. I say the things that many in Davos don't want to hear. And to the credit of the Davos people, and maybe they can have outliers like me because no one needs to take it seriously, but I will say that I get called repeatedly to speak at this and to add a voice that challenges the status quo in terms of all of that. And in fact, recently I've been one of the experts called in to be interviewed for one of their latest reports called the Great Narrative. So yeah, I go to all of these, but I don't suffer from the intellectual dishonesty that quite often sort of permeates many platforms.
Yeah, so you kind of know where I was going with that, because when I hear the sustainable state and I hear World Economic Forum, I think of Davos, and what you hear in our circles is that all the elites travel there in their private jets and then they fly back on their private jets. So a lot of hypocrisy. So I'm assuming that you're kind of fighting against that hypocrisy. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, I do a lot of work with a whole range of different organizations, but there are a whole lot of, you know, large companies who don't like what I'm saying. You know, how do you price carbon? How do you don't take a free ride on resources? And how do you change your business model? So I'm not popular in quite a few circles, but I come from an engineering and scientific background. So I root it all in the science. And if you can give me a better argument on how we address these existential threats, then I'm willing to accept and have a discussion. But you, to your point about elites gathering and speaking to issues without getting into the details and then glossing over it as though, you know, just another app and more money will solve this problem. Well, I'm the kind of person, if you read my books, who wants to bring reality to it. And I pride myself for trying to be intellectually honest. And I say very often that intellectual honesty is a scarce commodity these days. And the more elevated the platform you get onto, the scarcer it becomes. I've sat on map panels with many of the great and good. I'll not mention names here. And they have nothing to say for very often, partly because they're institutionally handcuffed. So they can't say what you and I can talk about now.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's why I think that you really never can trust somebody until you see how they make their money. And if you make your money independently, I believe you become more free. And it sounds like your entrepreneurial background has given you the courage to speak your mind. And I commend that. So I'm looking at your book and it talks about in chapter one, debunking sustainability, moving beyond the feel-good slogans. So as an entrepreneur, I built my business trying to escape the rat race to get out of the corporate space. And I'm thinking, how can I just make money? How can I offer something to the world that people want to pay me for it? And in my survival mode, I am not thinking about how do I save the planet? I'm thinking about how do I feed my family? How do I feed myself? So when I see people who are talking about entrepreneurship and sustainability, I'm thinking maybe that's tier three, tier four, tier five, almost like self-actualization, but survival comes first. So talking about it is really just a feel-good slogan, like you say in your book, and to put that first makes it very difficult for the entrepreneur to see how they serve the planet rather than serve their business or their customers first. So maybe if you can explain a little bit about what you're talking about in chapter one and how many people are just saying things but not doing anything about it.
No, very good. And I think, you make a good point. We should not conflate the idea of an entrepreneur with a large multinational. Large companies are not entrepreneurial anymore, as you probably know.
Great point. Very good point.
So I always tell CEOs who I meet and say they want to be entrepreneurs and how can we encourage entrepreneurs? I said, listen, man, if a young person is a great entrepreneur, they wouldn't be working for you because you'd be moving too far, too slowly. You have too many SOPs and too many procedures. You know, an entrepreneur gets up in the morning and they want to break all the rules and just get things done. So that's one thing we need to distinguish.
Good point.
To your audience of young entrepreneurs, people who I do believe, we want to make some money. But then, as I say, we don't have are not entitled to make profits by breaking all the rules, right? I think we all agree that. That's why we have certain rules. So the temptation to do whatever we want to make money is something that then there's a moral hazard. You and I can discuss what's the moral hazard in that. But most countries, and particularly developed countries like the US, et cetera, would have rules that prevent you from doing things that, you know, allows you to get away with things. So to the point of the sustainability debate, the point I was trying to say make there is many companies have slogans about sustainability, but actually don't practice sustainability.
Yes.
And there you get into much more profound, both intellectual, but also almost philosophical, but practical debate. So, for instance, you know, a lot of companies conflate pollution control and environmental management with sustainability. In my book, I describe what those two different things are. So if you are reducing the pollutants and you're an entrepreneur and you have a factory and you do certain things to reduce the pollution, et cetera, then you are being environmentally sensitive, you're obeying the laws, et cetera. But that doesn't make you sustainable. A sustainable person would be someone who says, hey, you know, I'm using a certain resource that could be depleted at a certain rate that if I continue on this trajectory will create an unsustainable future for the next generation. Now, that's a profound question to have to answer for any young entrepreneur. But you have to question that, and that therein lies the moral hazard. But there are also rules that allow you to understand what the boundaries are. So in the book, I argue, mainly in relation to large companies, please do not use the word sustainability when all you're doing is following environmental laws and regulations that, for instance, in the United States, the EPA set up in 1970, et cetera. And in 2020, you're just catching up. Good for you, but you're not talking about sustainability. Sustainability is something very different. And that requires profound questions. And those allude to the points you made about tier one, tier two, tier three. But I think for the young generation of entrepreneurs who are conscious of, you know, what they want to leave behind whilst making money, that's a good intellectual sort of framework to use to understand what's your contribution. I think none of us want to be making a lot of money and being wealthy and say, but man, I wrecked that whole, you know, part of that state or that city, and I contaminated the water, and I'm possibly responsible for 10,000, you know, cancer patients over a 20-year period or whatever. We none of us want to be doing that. So that's pollution control. But now the dilemma comes: what do I do if my product, it itself, is going to create harm? You see what I mean? Right? Long-term harm. That's a moral hazard question. The laws may allow you to do it, and therein lies a sustainability challenge, and that's what I meant by debunking it. A lot of large companies are not asking that question. I mean, if I give you one example, you know, I think all of us are very conscious these days about what we eat. Yes?
Oh, yeah. Not everybody, but I would say there's a growing trend.
We're trying to be.
There's a growing trend, for sure.
There's a growing trend. And I think many of us know that a lot of fast foods are not good for us. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, the government will regulate whether that fast food company will need to change a few ingredients because it's too much sugar. I mean, the sugar issue is big in the United States, even, right? Or the government will decide. So who decides whether it's okay to allow sugary drinks into schools for young kids? And I think that's a battle going on in different parts of the world. Those are discussions that companies have to take. The moral question for the CEO is, I think we need to take the sugar out. But then your product changes too. So these are dilemmas, and that's what I meant. That's a sustainability argument. The fact that I use my water more efficiently is something you have to do for a business imperative anyway, and the law requires you to do that. So you see what I mean. And all of us will struggle, both as businesses and individuals, is with the sustainability issue. You know, how much energy should I actually use? Just because I can afford to pay the price, is it okay for me to use this as much as I want, overheat my flat, whereas maybe I could leave it at, you know, just at the right temperature. And because energy is cheap, we overuse it. So those are the dilemmas at an individual level. But for an entrepreneur, it's an important question to ask at this point. And therein, to finish off, I say, comes the innovation. With all the technology we have today, with AI and the solutions, there is so much that we could do. But it takes just that other step. But therein also lies branding yourself very differently.
Now, one thing that I think of that is decreasing in the United States, for sure, but maybe it's across the world, is just spirituality and maybe belief in God. I don't know if there's something that you're seeing, but I definitely noticed that people are not going to church. They're not believing like they once did. And the reason why I bring that up is because maybe when it comes to the environment, I believe many people look to man, look to government. And back in the day, they used to look to God. Case in point, whenever I was growing up and I would be traveling around the woods, I knew it was wrong to kind of destroy everything. Not because a man told me to do it, but because it was, you know, I instilled within my religion, within my spirituality. Don't crush trees unless you have to. Don't litter in the woods because it's basically sacred ground to some people, right? And I look at it that way as sustainability. But nowadays, people are like, all right, what does the government say what I can and can't do? And that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. I mean, you look like you're 25, so that was not too long ago, I suppose.
I'm 39. I appreciate that. You're a charmer.
All right. But so you're right? So you were a kid 30 years ago, and things were slightly different. And so look at what's happened in the blink of an eye. We have just taken access to resources as a right and not as a privilege, right? So access to a woods, as you said, to walk and enjoy, is a privilege, and you learned, and you know, it goes back a long way to the First Nation people, all of that, to respect the land and the animals and all of that.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. In many parts of the world, the scramble, and this is a longer conversation, I don't have time to get in, but we live, even when if you're 39 years old, and when you were born, the world's population was half what it is today. About 4 billion. So imagine human populations being around for, you know, tens of thousands of years. In the space of 40 years in your lifetime, we doubled.
Wow.
And
wow.
You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know. If you doubled the amount of people in a small town in the blink of an eye, you create a lot of tensions. And then you decide to essentially put an economic value to everything. So in many parts of the world, a forest is of only use when we cut it down. It's got no use otherwise. There's no value, right? So all of these things have perverted, in a way, the consciousness that you talk about. Call it spirituality, call it value systems. But we live in a very crowded planet, very crowded. And I just gave you one data point there. The world's population doubled in your lifetime. It was 1 billion 200 years ago. It's 8 billion now. It'll peak at about 10. And then we have an economic model which is premised on you have a right to consume anything you want. And there are companies creating all of these things. And I think the new entrepreneur is someone who understands that I'm producing goods and services that are essentially bound within the limits. And I'm using technology that allows me to provide services that allow people to enjoy certain things within certain restrictions, et cetera. And I think that's where, you know, the next generation of entrepreneurs should be thinking, weighing up their responsibilities, because that's exactly what you're talking about, consciousness. And I don't like to talk about it too much, because then people think you're some kind of religious yoga or yogi, or, you know, you're a Buddhist monk and you want to go to Tibet and meditate for 3 years, three months and 3 days and 3 hours. So, but we need to accept that the consciousness is an important element of the trajectory of how we live in a world with huge amounts of technological potential and still lots of needs to be fulfilled.
So in your opinion, do you think that spirituality should be more adopted, or do you think that's an ingredient to a better future? Do you believe yes or no to that?
I believe it should be something that everyone becomes more aware of. And I think it's important we don't conflate with religious beliefs, but I think a consciousness, a spirituality, I like the word spirituality,
Yeah.
Because, you know, once we bring religion and then people get funny and my religion's better than yours and all of that.
Right.
But the
right.
spirituality,
that's why I said that.
The spirituality thing is very important and we should not conflate it with religion. How you experience that, but the awareness of us being part of something bigger and appreciating, respecting that, that I believe is very important.
I'm with you. And the reason why I say spirituality is I'm total agreement that the moment that somebody says religion, it does create division, right? But spirituality, yeah. Believing there's a higher power, it unites us. And I think that whenever you have a connection to God, you look at individuals at a lower level, and therefore man or woman, you could see corruption a lot easier because you don't listen to man. You don't listen to government. You listen to God internally, right? So that's the way I look at it. But anyways, whenever I look at your table here, I found this fascinating. I never really understood how you could break it down, but this is pretty simple. You say environmental protection is very different than sustainable development, and you broke it down a bit ago. But
yes.
I look at environmental protection, like who doesn't agree with cleaner fuel, emission standards, noise barriers? But then it gets a little dicey in the sustainable development. This is where you'll feel a lot of pushback. And I think, I don't know if this is your remedy, but road taxes on car ownership a little bit more, right? Bans reducing car parks. Tell us a little bit about the breakdown when it comes to mobility, energy, housing, and water, food, agriculture, all of that.
Yeah, you know, great that you picked up on that. Very few people pick up on that. So that's the controversial bit. And as you said at the start, people write books, not because they believe they're completely right about something, but they have an idea that they would like to put out there. And then smarter people engage in that debate. But this is the point I'm trying to make. If I often say car ownership is not a human right. Now, I know that if I say that in the USA, they think, here comes some guy who's crazy. So it's all contextual, right? So
I believe it's a privilege. To have a license is a privilege. You do something bad to the society around you, you lose that privilege, in my opinion. So I'm with you.
Yeah. So then, the USA is a vast country. Where driving is a part of life, et cetera. And the automotive was sort of invented and used because of the vastness of the territory. But if you live in my part of the world, and I don't know if you've been to Asia, if you haven't, you got to come next month, man. You be my guest. Okay. So if you come to this part of the world and you go to Manila, Jakarta, or Mumbai, you will say to me, oh, now I get it. All right. Because we have gridlocks where children get up at 5 a.m. to get to school at 7:30. And they spend 3 to 5 hours on the road back and forth. This is not natural. So two problems here. We have created mega cities with populations of 15 to 20 million people. Right. We have then allowed the automotive to essentially invade this whole space. The cost is getting cheaper and it's gridlock. And so there's a whole host of different things. So what I say in our part of the world, we're so crowded in the cities and therefore productivity and all of that is hugely affected. What you have a right to is mobility. You don't have a right to a private car where your usage of that privilege essentially exacerbates a wider social problem, from air pollution to congestion to land rights to housing valuations, recreation space, and everything else. So what then the government has to do when it comes to public transport, that's the role of the state. How it does that, it depends on how it wants to, it can privatize it as it can do in different parts. So if you go to Tokyo, for instance, which is one of the most crowded cities in the world, beautiful. 15 to 20 million people, depending on where you draw the boundaries of Greater Tokyo. But there's no traffic jams because most Japanese people don't drive a car on a workday. The mass transit is so efficient. So I live in Hong Kong. I don't even own a car because I can get to work in 20 minutes with public transport.
Wow.
I live in the street. I'm more privileged. I've got bankers on my street. They take the public transport. It's safe. And during the peak travel times, the mass transit, the underground train, you have one train arriving every 90 seconds. So that's technology and at its finest and public order. So everyone goes to work in that way. So that was the point I'm trying to make. Then in different parts of the world, different governments will have to deal with it. And if you're then dealing with the emissions issue and air pollution, but climate with climate change, then you're going to have to deal with the issue about how many cars can someone own in a crowded city, right? And therein lies, therefore, regulation. So that's what the sustainability debate is. So last point I'll make with make on that, Mike, to give your viewers an example too. So in Singapore, what they did is to say, we're too small a place. If you guys all have cars, we're going to live in a terribly polluted place, and efficiencies in terms of productivity, going to work, et cetera, will be a nightmare. So what they did was use technology, one of the first cities going back 20 years, to essentially price your privilege to drive. And in certain parts of the city, if you enter, it's automatic. You just get billed for driving at certain hour, certain times of day. It's called electronic road pricing. So there are many ways technologies. And the guys who came up with that, of course, made a lot of money too. So there's a lot more things one can talk about in terms of how you could do that. I think that need to curb this sort of congestion with AI, we could go on to another level of technological use to serve them. So that's the difficult point. But governments intervened. So in Singapore, there was no question. The government intervened. Everyone followed. It became the norm. Now everyone's grateful that they have a system such as that. But they had to make sure that the public transport system was world class. Didn't have to wait. And I've not used the subway in New York for a long time, but I did once. It was scary. Yes. And I believe it's even more scary these days.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's the difference. Whereas you go into the subway in Hong Kong, it is, you can go there at midnight and there are no crazies around, and the train's very safe and it's pristine and clean.
Well, do you know, I can only assume why. You're very familiar with that world, but I can only assume why. And what I believe is the crime punishment is extreme there, which I totally believe in. You do anything bad to somebody else, you are going to suffer for a very long time. Do you agree that that is part of the equation to make it a very world-class environment?
Rules are very, very tough, and people get normalized to it. So in Hong Kong, corruption is very low. We had two of the most senior government people here, two of the most senior people over the last 10 years, both go to jail for what you and I would consider minor sort of infringements of the law. They didn't kill anyone or steal a lot of money. They took a little favor from a business leader. They went to jail. Mm. In Singapore, it's tough as hell.
If you steal from somebody on a train, or if you hurt somebody, I believe they have quick trials there. They have quick trials.
Yeah, yep. Immediately.
Death penalty is very high. Is that so, right?
For possession of arms.
Yes. There you go.
And for possession of drugs.
Yes. There you go. So in my opinion, when I hear people in the United States say we need to be more lenient, I believe that creates way more disruption, causing the public system to crumble even more. And I'm with you. I think that if a society gets so overwhelmed with people, the government will step in and create some type of transportation system that, number one, is good for society, but for the environment. Yes. And here's where I differ. The only way this is where we differ. I believe that you have to make it so world-class, so much better, have the free market choose that that's the better path than owning the car. And once you do that, that's beautiful. And the reason why I kind of lean in on my spirituality, when you talk about how there's abundance to capitalize on or to stop somebody from owning a car or having children or creating wealth, in my opinion, you're leaning into maybe equal outcome rather than equal opportunity. And that's where it gets really, really scary, because I'm not sure if you've ever read the Bible, but there's a story about the story of the talents. And if we're born in the likeness,
I've read the Bible, the Quran, and the Hindu classics too.
Beautiful. So you get this, that there's a story of the talents where
I was brought up in a missionary school. I said the Lord's Prayer every day.
No wonder you're so well educated. You've read them all.
Yeah, so in the morning I said my Hindu prayers. I went to school and then I did the Lord's Prayer. So we were, you know, pretty open-minded. We're pretty cool. And we embraced all the faiths. And you're right about, you know, the alternatives have to be good. So yes. That people understand I have an option. I'm not being restricted. I'm not being pushed into one way, right?
Yes.
And then I have. And then there are certain laws that each society will define, which what I call allows the collective interest to supersede the individual only without suppressing the individual. You see what I mean? Uh-huh. So you have to, and the Japanese society is a great example of this. So in Japan, you know, the culture is such that every Japanese person from education, so you can call it a spiritual education because it's rooted in the Shinto belief, etc. Every kid is taught from a very early age, you do not stand out for yourself. You're part of the collective. So everyone has to. So every kid in Japan has to take part in cleaning the schoolyard.
Hmm.
Right?
It's a ritual. I like that.
Yeah, you have to come and you have to clean the schoolyard. And then there's a rota system and parents have to join so that they're teaching the kids and they're joining and owning the way the school looks. You have to clean the toilets. You have to understand. So you're taking collective responsibility. You can express yourself individually, but the collective interest overrides your individual self-interest.
That's an instinctive moral code that they instill, right?
That's right. From a very early age. In Korea, too. That doesn't mean that some don't behave badly, but it's sort of in that system. And I know, where I come from, I'm originally from Malaysia, and, you know, it has lots of good things. But our value systems have corroded because of political, misgovernment, bad governance, corruption, etc. So when you have that, then the society's overall standards are lowered because people don't know where to look. And then the same things that entices politicians to make bad decisions make them interfere in the education system, etc., and the values are corroded. So this is really important that, you know, the value systems are enshrined, and leaders and these days, political leaders, because they have such prominence and too much power, in my view, should be setting the examples. And when our societies allow for them to behave badly, then we are essentially sowing the seeds for a slow and sure decline.
So what I've seen, and you probably notice it from being in Hong Kong, looking at Western society, just individual accountability, responsibility is decreasing. And yes. You have individuals who can't even agree on the term what a woman or a woman, what a man is.
I know.
And if you can't
I wish you luck with that stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
So you know, my friends asked me, I said, oh man, I wish you luck. Good luck with that stuff.
Yeah, we're on the same page here, because if you can't communicate, how are you ever going to work as a team and work towards a common goal of keeping the planet safe and, strong, right? So when that happens, okay, no communication breakdown. Also, the fact that you have politicians / doctors out there saying, well, this individual feels a certain way, so allow them to do whatever they want to do. And I'm like, wait a second, we're on this planet together. We're on the same team. We're all humans. If we can't communicate or agree, or you're not looking at truth, but you're going off of feelings, you got a big breakdown coming, whether it's now or later.
Now, I know that conversation in the US, and I'll just take 1 minute to tell you, I was having lunch with a German friend of mine. He's a CEO of a company in Germany. He's in Hong Kong. I coach his team. So we had lunch and debriefed, etc. And I said to him, how's your son doing? He said, he's good, man. He's 7. But he said, man, the pressures at school, you know, to all of this, are you a boy and a girl, etc. And he said, it's crazy. And I said, how do you cope with that? He said, well, you know, we just get him to, you know, do things that he likes. Because he told me an instance that apparently when the boy was 4, he just said to his dad, I think I'm a girl. And the dad and mom's just like, okay, whatever. But they didn't say, oh, let's take you to the doctor and let's take you to the psychologist and find out if you need to wear a dress. And 3 years later, you know, the guy's just being a boy, right? I mean, all of just being a boy, and apparently loved to play football and all of that. So I know it's traumatizing. At least my friend was a trauma for him. And he said, luckily, he didn't say it to a teacher who might have taken him to the doctor immediately.
Yeah, behind the parents' back, by the way. That's what's
That's
happening.
Right. So I heard there's some stuff like that as well, that under a certain age, the kid has a right to do certain things. So I forget, but it's messed up. I really wish you all the best of luck with that stuff.
Hey, I'm in 1993, I wanted to be a professional basketball player. Now, if you know me, I'm a 5'7" white guy. There's no chance I'm making it to the basketball leagues, right? So, you know, things change, right? And for you to say, all right, I feel a certain way, this is what I'm going to be for the rest of my life, is insanity. And so anytime there's surgery involved, I think it's just craziness. I think that's disrupting the family bond, but also when it comes to neighbor to neighbor. And I don't think we'll ever have a sustainable earth unless we're all on the same page when it comes to basic stuff like that. So I'm with you, man. Last question I have for you is the big pushback on sustainable, that word is everybody's focusing on equal outcome rather than equal opportunity. As a capitalist, as an entrepreneur, and people who listen to this podcast, we're all about equal opportunity. But depending on if you're corrupt, if you don't offer a good product, if you're a scumbag, or if you're really good, you're going to have a different outcome no matter what. So how do you justify that when it comes to, it looks like maybe you know some ways to explain this sustainable outcome by, you know, whether it's limitations, taxes, or, you know, certain rights. What do you say to people like me who say, hey, anytime anybody comes in and wants to push sustainability, they're looking at their pockets and an equal opportunity for people who don't even try anymore. So tell me about this, if you can.
Yeah, Mike, good. So the first thing I'll say is, you know, don't put everyone in that same bucket. You know, don't get into that ideological trap. So the first thing is, you know, give them a platform to explain. So the other thing I would say is, outcomes are important. And then you and I have to decide, right? As an entrepreneur, I decide, is this outcome something I can live with? And if I believe, as you said, from a spiritual or a value-based system, that I have a contribution to make. I can't change the world. But in this little arena of what I want to do, I have to make a contribution. But as one part of my business model, and I always talk about business models, by the way. So part of my business model, I need to change. That's, for me, the challenge of a great entrepreneur, right? Mm-hmm. Tweak my business model without compromising on what I want to achieve, but knowing where my moral compass is. I can't go down this route because the science is very clear. So I always say, you know, the way to look at it if you're an entrepreneur is what I call map out the externalities of your business model. If the externalities are clear and you can live with it, and you think there are no perverse outcomes from the externalities, and that he doesn't break any law. The first thing is, of course, you don't want to break any laws. So that's usually under the sort of pollution and environmental protection. But in the sustainability arena, then you have to look at which externalities do I feel across a generation I would not have made worse and that I can live with. And that's our moral compass, right? So, you know, I look at your example of the forest. I'm an entrepreneur. I've got access now to that little bit of forest that you had there. And, you know, the local authorities have said, yeah, you can go in there and you can do this and that and that. And then you have to say, hey, you know, is that something I want to do? Because it would be irreversible change on a scale that the next generation cannot enjoy. I enjoyed it and I can't. That's a moral dilemma and a discussion that we have to have with ourselves. If that irreversible change is minute, then we all can't pretend to be, you know, saints trying to save the world. We might take that on. But these are the sort of I think, tough decisions, but it goes back to your business model. Look at your business model. If you can live with the what I call the externalities map of your business model, then go ahead and do it. But don't put everyone who, and let's not have a fight about sustainability. Let's have a discussion. And let's not think that everyone who brings that agenda has some sort of ulterior motive to stop the world, et cetera. Some of these people, some of the people, and I have many friends, and you know, sometimes I get accused of it until I explain. They have good motives, you have to understand. And then if we work together, to your earlier point, we might actually find some very good solutions in that too. This comes back to your point that we get into arguments too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to essentially be more, hey, what do you mean by that? And too many people are not good at explaining, including the sort of the people who are advocates of sustainability and all of that. And they just want to say, you're a bad guy because you're a business person. You're trying to make money. You're an entrepreneur. So you have no respect for sustainability. That's very unproductive as well. I don't know if I've helped you answer that, but I think we should just talk. We should use the science to allow us to think through these things, get a bit more informed about these things, and always do a mapping of your business model. It's quite easy to figure out. Then you have to make decisions. The first barrier is I don't break any laws. The second is, what do I think these externalities mean over a period of time? Generation, whatever. What's my legacy, if I can use that word?
Well, we agree. It sounds like on many, many aspects. I didn't see that coming, to be honest, but it sounds like part of your recipe is think more like an entrepreneur, right? And I say that over and over to my team. Think like an entrepreneur because you could solve problems. You could do things better. You could become more efficient every step of the way. We also talked about harsher punishments. We agree with that. So maybe that will create more of a sustainable future where people won't be breaking laws as much when it comes to hurting people and whatnot.
I mean, yeah. You know, sometimes when you talk about harsher punishments, people think you're advocating capital punishment. I'm not talking about that. But there needs to be, you know, tough rules. You can't do this. You can't do that because the collective welfare is at stake here. And that's clearly, you know, one of the things that I talk about. And very too often, governments have, you know, let things that protect public good from being taken care of with the right type of rules and regulations and the consequences for breaking those laws. So I can say in many parts of Asia, you know, many powerful people have made tons of money by breaking all the laws and leaving behind sort of wastelands, you know, in forests, waters, etc. And nobody went to jail. I mean, it was like that in the US in the early days, etc. And no one went to jail. So the rules need to be tough.
Yeah, well, I think that when it comes to the subway system, public transportation, make it unthinkable to litter, to hurt people, all that. Because if you can make that a shining object of success, you will start to see people move over to them and trust them more and trust the system. So I'm with you there. But also, it sounds like the more free speech, the better, right? The more people can actually communicate, say what they really feel about things, the better the dialogue, the better the conversations, the better the outcome. And then
exactly.
And so once you have all those things in place, I'm with you. We're agreeing a lot more than I thought we would. So,
you know, I think, you know, I mean, just a quick word about free speech, right? You know, I come from a multicultural society. And as you know, free speech comes with great responsibility. So when you have that privilege of exercising free speech, please use it with great responsibility. I can't go and I come from a multiracial, multicultural country. I should not be using the privilege of free speech to insult other people. That is not free speech. For me, that is inciting violence or whatever you want. So I think free speech is such an important thing. But a lot of people abuse it, thinking free speech means I can express anything I want. And I think to some degree in certain countries, it's okay. In some countries, it isn't. So I exercise my free speech and the privileges I have with great care in order to, you know, advance certain things. And I come back to the railways and to the mass transit system. You're so right. In the Hong Kong system, you will not see one piece of graffiti. Not one. You will not see any litter on the
Bingo.
Train. And you know what happened? People just became normalized to the idea of taking pride in the public asset.
Keep it clean. Yes.
Keep it clean.
Man, and anytime there's drugs being sold or bought, make it so, so unthinkable that it never will happen again.
I mean, for me, that's unimaginable to even think about that. These things don't exist.
There you go. God, that's how you make a sustainable environment. So I'm with you. Guys, the book is called The Sustainable State, The Future of Government, Economy, and Society. Never saw it coming that we are totally in agreement with many aspects. Maybe not everything, but not everybody is. So Chandra Nair, he's a professional. By the way, if you ever get in touch with him, this guy he's great. He does a masterclass in communication back and forth. So I respect that in people. And is there a way for people to get in touch with you outside of your book? Is there a LinkedIn or an X account or anything you want
to? Yeah, they can get in touch with me on LinkedIn is probably the easiest way to get in touch. Or write to Chandra Nair at the Global Institute for Tomorrow Inquiry. Just drop me a message on that. The Global Institute for Tomorrow.
Founder and CEO of the Global Institute for Tomorrow. So,
and you know, Mike, if you give me for 30 seconds for your audience, I've just, as an entrepreneur, I've just 2 years ago created an education platform that essentially talks about all of this and how we need to redesign societies. So it's called gift.ed, and the platform is called Redesign Society, Disruptive Learning. And it's really thinking afresh about how we, as you've been pointing out, in your own experience, so many things have broken down. We have to redesign. In less developed countries, we have to create new things. I think, as you're pointing out, in the more advanced countries, things have broken down. My colleague in Hong Kong, he's American, he's from San Francisco. He said, man, I can't go home. Because every time I go home and I see what's happening in San Fran, he said, I have to leave because it's so distressing, you know? So this platform is called gift.ed, and it's Redesign Society, Disruptive Learning. It's a whole new curriculum, and I'm happy to share this with anyone. And any entrepreneurs want to invest in this, call me up.
Excellent. Gift.ed. I got to look that up. I have not seen it yet, but you're a true professional, man. I'm really honored to talk with you, and let's talk further. You also have multiple other books. I think this has been an interesting conversation. I can't wait to see what people say about it. So come back on some other time, okay?
Anytime, and I'll send you some links to gift.ed.
Beautiful.
I'll send you some links.
Guys, his book is called The Sustainable State. It's on Amazon. It's resonating, 4.8 stars. And I recommend you get in touch with this guy because he's very well connected and he still has his head on his shoulders the right way. So it's great to talk to people like that. Remember, $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.